Hello, everyone. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. I'm really happy to see you here. Thank you for coming again. Tonight, we are going to be discussing some things to inspire curiosity and hopefully consider some of life's mysteries in a little bit more light, or at least highlight the shadows and give them more depth. So I would like you to consider the act of driving a car. When we're sitting behind the wheel in our seats and driving down, we cohabitate with thousands, but in reality, millions of other drivers, if we consider the entire road systems. Yet, the act of driving I was considering today, and not the literal speed laws, like the signs that tell you how fast to drive, whatever those are, wherever you are located, even if you are in a different country. I'm not really quite knowledgeable about how the traffic law is in other places. I do know that there's places like the Autobahn where there is no speed limit, but you don't really follow that sign purely, you know, because we're cohabitating on the road. And I think that you have to drive a certain speed to be able to do that without pissing people off or becoming too reckless. And so you have to drive just fast enough. But if you drive too fast, you have to dodge in and out of traffic and that recklessness. But if you drive too slow, you have people pile up behind you and you make people angry, right? So another way to tell the story in a much more fabulistic fashion, whereas my metaphor might be a little murky if you haven't caught what I'm digging at yet. Let's consider the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. The story that I had at the top of my dome without having to do much research that I had been exposed to in my childhood concerned three bears living their lives and a small child who happened upon the house of the bears while the bears were not in, and the door happens to be open. And so Goldilocks goes inside because she's a little girl and she's hungry. And when she gets in there, she finds three pots of porridge. One's very hot, one's not very hot, and one's cold, you know. The hot one is Papa Bears, and the cold one is Mama Bears, and the one that's right in the middle is Little Baby Bears. So, of course, she likes the baby's porridge. Then she finds their stools when she's trying to figure out where she wants to sit down to eat the porridge. And there's one huge stool, one medium-sized stool, and one little stool. So she's a little girl. And so then she has to find a place to sleep because she's well fed. So she goes and she finds a huge bed, and you get the gist of it at this point. There's a couple more twists in the story that I did not know about, but I wanted to dig into it a little bit more. And I used a website called Owlcation. It's a pseudo edu style newsletter. It looked Maybe they're designing things better, even from educational standpoints. But I'm very wary on the internet, so I want to be very careful when I give you any of my researched information, because, as always, I never really look that deep. But according to Owlcation, the original Goldilocks was written by a dude named Robert Southey in 1837. And his story that was published, there was actually an old lady who broke into the house. And so most renditions, even after the old lady was switched for a younger persona, she had silver hair. And the term Goldilocks and golden hair was a later addition yet again. The transition from old lady to little girl was done by a man named Joseph Kundle in 1850. But there's also a lot of dispute because there's a lot of stories where foxes would break into a bear's house and steal their food. And those ones predate both of the human versions. So I found that very interesting. How much the story has twisted and changed with time, because the way that we tell stories is an evolutionary, if completely creative, but evolutionary too, because through the creative process and through generation, stories change and amalgamate, they collect more cultural baggage, you know? And so the reason that the dude even wanted to switch it to a little girl is because in the older versions of the story, they were completely criminal when they entered the house. The door was completely shut, and the fox and the old lady were mean-spirited villains. And Mr. Kundle thought that the old lady trope was a beaten horse. And so it was necessary to switch it so it was a little bit more palatable, at least from a salesman standpoint, to push the story. So, yeah, it's all very interesting. Not to digress. But the story of Goldilocks, whether it's criminal or whether it's fanciful, the moral that I always picked up out of it was that there's typically three options and three ways that things can be presented to us in our lives. And the best option is typically the one that's in the middle. You know, you can have food that's too spicy or too bland, but you got to have a little bit of kick, but not enough to hurt you, you know? So tonight, I would like to discuss centrality, the middle path, the middle way, or Aristotle's golden mean. Here, just to throw some quotes at you. Aristotle said, and I didn't have my book out, so I wasn't able to get a nice page number, but I did remember reading this from his Organon, which is a really dry, logical diagnosis on arguments and how to put arguments together with syntax and A plus B equals C and just really, really hard, not very fun logic. But I was able to find the quote online very easily, which I'm not even going to use the website because it's pretty much common law at this point. Virtue is the golden mean between two vices. On the one of excess, the other of deficiency. Two vices, too much and too little. Whereas virtue, which is gold, which if we round out things, we end up in the middle. That's what the definition of a mean is mathematically. So Lao Tzu had a couple things to say about this, I believe, as well. One, hope and fear are both phantoms that arise from thinking of the self. When we don't see the self as self, what do we have to fear? And then he says, the wise man is square, but not sharp, honest, but not malign, straight, but not severe, bright, but not dazzling. And then he says, fill your bowl to the brim, and it will spill. Keep sharpening your knife, and it will blunt. From the Christian Bible, Ecclesiastes 7:18-20. Keep to the middle of the road. You can do this if you truly respect God. Wisdom will make you stronger than the 10 most powerful leaders in your city. No one in the world always does right. What is the middle path? What does it mean to even be in the middle? And I know I've spoken about this a lot because this is pretty much my main desire in life, is to figure out how to be as unobnoxious as physically possible. And I feel that the middle path is the way to do that. To piggyback off of the golden mean, this makes me immediately think of the golden rule. I have this strong memory of like kindergarten or first grade and being at the water fountain and watching some kid like literally like suck on the water fountain because he was so close to it. And like I didn't even want to use it. And then like for a very long time after that, like I just remember like the like my dad in my head, like, how would you like it if somebody did that to you? You know, if somebody else's action hurts you, like if somebody hurts me, my first response, going back to that moment almost, it's always been that water fountain for some reason, to an extent. This is just gross, but of course there's several other things. And my father's examples, of course. But if I've been harmed, you know, that immediately means that, damn, I don't ever want to ever hurt anybody else like this, you know? I find it just horrible to carry around the feeling if I do end up hurting somebody, even unintentionally. So I found the golden rule to have this plasticity where it has a bidirectional quality where however you say whatever's happening to me immediately implies what's happening to you. And I think that's necessary. And throughout all of my separation and throughout all of my isolation throughout my life, you know, at the root of my ethical philosophy going back to childhood has always been that crucial point, that golden rule. You know, why am I even bringing up this? If there is a me and there is a you, and if we are separate, this means that I can have a preference for me. As soon as I wake, like as soon as I wake up into reality in the morning, you know, I can begin to preference myself and fall towards selfish me-dom. And if I do that, you know, it's just me. And that's really depressing. Honestly. Whereas if I'm a pushover and I only preference others, which I've also happened to do in my past, that ruins myself. And there is no longer a me any longer. What I'm saying is that if I stay at the golden rule and I'm always putting my position into respecting you as much as me, which is how I was taught, this for me has always symbolically dissolved the you-me dichotomy. That's why I care so much, and it's how I can love a stranger so heavily, because I've always seen the us, you know, instead of the them. It's been a lot more comfortable for me. It's the first step towards thinking mindfully of others. The first step is that golden rule. It makes it easier to have a better calculation and to trust the calculation when we are trying to measure out our golden means in life. Does that make any sense at all? I see there is a linkage between using our practiced golden rule to be able to walk a better middle path. Because I really feel that walking the middle path is the worst sobriety test that has ever been, ever. And none of us are even close to sober enough to accomplish it. At least I'm not. And I'm not even talking about intoxication in the material way here, guys. You know? But I see this middle path as almost a precipice. You know, a very steep, steep, jagged crest that I'm walking upon that's like very thin, and on either side is a cliff. And I've always found it so hard to not fall one way or the other and to leapfrog back and forth on a good day. And so all of my discipline is figuring out how to find that centrality. And it's a work in progress. And I hope I'm saying something pseudo-enlightening here. Remember that my email address is very available. It is thegingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com. You can find that in the show notes. Please email me if you have any ideas about the middle path or centrality, if it relates to your religion or your spirituality or even your just philosophical bend in life, or if you've never thought about it, if you're curious, and if you've never thought about that you've thought about it and now you're realizing that you did and you have some brilliant insight, I would love to add it on. So please freely share all of your opinions and beliefs. It's not that the fall harms as bad as falling off of the precipice turns us into a boulder, and then we, as the boulder, cause some sort of collateral damage. You know, within my golden rule and my heavy guilty conscience and my tendency towards shame, I've never wanted to disadvantage anyone. Ever. I never wanted to hurt anyone, and that doesn't even mean physically either. Like, you know, when somebody dislikes you, have you ever been able to easily tell if they dislike you? You know, I can feel it heavily, and it's like I never take it out on the other person, even though it has nothing to do with me in reality. You know, somebody's perception of you has nothing to do with who you are. Their opinion of you, what they say about you, has nothing to do with who you are, because who you are is completely what you do. And what you do is your action and no one else's. And their words are just another action, just like thoughts are just another action. You know, your being and your doing are separate from all of that. Somebody's perception of you is completely a reflection of their own bad day. And if there's something in you that they don't like, it's probably something that they need to work on in themselves. And what they don't like is something that they either admire or that is in conflict with something they don't like in themselves. But the big part about being reckless or underwhelming in a situation such as under driving can be just as dangerous as reckless driving, to bring up that metaphor. Driving too slow can be dangerous too. And when you have people swerving around you, that can cause traffic and that can cause people to crash into each other too. You know, so it's not just like disadvantage, like it's some weak, oh, you're irking me. You know, like it can be dangerous too, is my point. Yet, I still find myself hopeful that when I look and I seek for this, that I'm finding some sort of not quite balance in life per se, but I find when I don't put myself into situations, like Lao Tzu said, when you drop self, what do you have to fear? When I don't put myself into situations, when I am just in the situation, being in it, and not, because I feel the over and the under comes from some sort of exertion on the person's part. Does that make any sense? Maybe not. Taoist non-doing is action through inaction. I've discussed this on the show before, but I'm going to go over it again, not to pander to you. Sometimes the best action that we can do is not doing. Sometimes the best way to fight somebody is to avoid the punch instead of trying to outbeat them, especially if your opponent is larger than you. I know I might be rambling a little bit tonight, but I had some esoteric thoughts and conundrums, and honestly, I'm confused myself, and that's what this show is about, because at the heart of curiosity is confusion. So what does it mean to be in the middle? You know, you can be in the middle, like physically. You can be like the middle child in a family. Being the middle child versus being the only child is such a different ordeal, I suppose, because I was an only child for a while. Now I'm not. I got a bunch of little sisters, but I'm so much older than most of them. And so there's this very weirdness where I feel like I'm a strange uncle that's also a brother, uncle brother. But no, you can't say that. That's fucked up. That sounds awful. That's some weird fucking, you know, forest people shit. I'm sorry, my family too. That was awful. But there's a huge difference in perception being an only child and experiencing life as the sole consumer of the parental love, and the middle child who is born like wedged in between an older and a younger. And then like, I've heard like the middle child kind of just gets ditched out, because like the first kid got soul love for a while, and the youngest kid's the one who's currently getting all the attention. The middle child's just screwed, you know, a little bit. Maybe, I don't know. That's what I've heard. So, you know, Malcolm in the Middle is funny, but physically, we're often wedged into the middle of things. You know, societally, we're in the middle, you know, based upon status. You know, I'm at the very bottom of the totem pole of social status when it comes to jobs and shit. You know, but you can be middle class, you know, financially. And of course, money leads to social standings and social power. Politically, there's the bullshit of a, what do you even call it? What do you call that crap show that is the American political system, the Democratic versus Republicans, the stupid ass teams with an elephant on one side and a ass on the other? But what even is libertarian? What is even moderate? I don't see anything in the middle in politics, honestly. I think that's what people are crying for, and that's what these moderates and these libertarian libs, what are they? You know, but nobody's truly walking the precipice in politics, because everybody is trying to get something from somebody. And it's such a war field, You know, Chogyam Trungpa said, a warrior doesn't commit warfare. A warrior conducts him or herself in life genuinely and gently with compassion and love. And warfare is the exact opposite of compassion. It is aggression and recklessness, you know. But I digress. You can have, there's a temperamental gas and accelerometer that we exist in. We can come in hot, we can come in cold, you know. And when I say hot, we can come in like ferocious. We can, and that could be either angry or just hype, you know. Being too low is like, you know, being tired or hurt, or, and these are just natural things. And I'm not saying either's bad. I'm not saying it's really bad to come in hot or bad to come in cold. I'm saying I would like to be neither, but I'm also not condoning it. That's exactly what I'm doing. I'm condoning both. And that's because you can't punish either human reactions, you know, like it's human, but it's their business. It's not yours. And even if it flacks on you, it doesn't have anything to do with you, you know, and you can defend yourself and remove yourself from the situation, you know, but don't put yourself in the situation. And as soon as you get angry at the situation, you are in the situation committing warfare, you know, and that decision to battle doesn't have to happen, if that makes any sense. I'm a pacifist. There are spiritual leanings, you know. I like thinking agnosticism is the middle path, and my breed of agnosticism is full spirit versus no spirit. And on one side there is nothing, and on the other side there is everything. And I really firmly believe that all things are equally viable and have the opportunity to happen. But I don't know if I'll ever see it or see things, or if anybody ever will. You know, there's no afterlives until there's lights out. We don't know if there's nothing or if there's something. So that's my breed of agnosticism. Within religious conversations and spiritual genuflect, there is discussion of good and evil. What is good? What is bad? The subjectivity of deciding what is good and bad is yet again very human. But I find that the middle ground would be where there is no good or bad, or where the thing that is considered is equally good and bad enough that it is so ambiguous that nobody can make a decision about it. You have sect versus sect. Catholicism and Protestantism has had bickerment in the past, and people have huge verbal and physical warfare based around differences in religion, period, even if they're worshiping the same Abrahamic God. And the ones that I am mentioning here are probably, and I haven't looked at the national news for a while, but Islam and Judaism. One's very old, one's very young, but in my eyes, I see them worshiping the same God and yet burning each other in this earthly plane. And I don't see how their gods, even if they do believe in a jihad or some sort of defense or whatever response to aggression, as soon as we put ourselves in the battle. I hate speaking politics, but I put myself here. So in sect versus sect, I find the middle ground yet again, acceptance or total tolerance. Even people in war knew to respect other people's gods in ancient history. The Persians, when the Persians would land into another country, they would let the people that they would conquer keep all of their customs. They'd even often let them keep their politicians. They would just go, "You're Persians now." You know, You don't mess with a person's beliefs, even in control and warfare, which I would say is the darkest place to be in a human society. So when you openly abuse those things, what is happening? Even in small social groups such as friendships, there can be sides that have to be chosen. When people break up, you know, who keeps whose friends? Who am I allowed to hang out with now? Who are you allowed to hang out with now? Even just in a simple argument, are you overstepping by being in another person's presence, even though you're both friends and you equally love and respect all? I don't know anything. That's the only thing I'm sure of. Yet I can't help thinking about all these things every day and where I would want to put myself and how, if somebody saw my actions, they would take my actions and reflect them back to me. And what I get reflected back is goodwill, because what I gave out was goodwill. That's the cycle. Good on good. Love on love. You know, you give good and it comes back, but you don't expect it, because as soon as you start expecting to get good, you get spite. That's all you get. Well, we've wandered through some really tricky paths tonight. If you're still with me, thank you. I know this is a little confusing. I'm confused. So these extremes and vice that Aristotle had mentioned, where one extreme is too much, the other extreme is deficiency, too little. You know, let's look at some of the extremes that can be portrayed in a day and in our actions. These are things that I've thought about in my own. We can have extremes in behaviors where on one end, the too much, we're risky, as in the car metaphor. You can be a speed demon. You know, you can be an adrenaline junkie to good effort. You know, I've never been one to go for too much thrill. I'm very sensitive to adrenaline. I get really sick from that feeling. You know, I've never really liked it that much. I get dizzy. I'm very meek and cautious. Never broken a bone. Well, actually, I broke my toe. I broke my toe a couple weeks ago. So that was the first bone I've broken. But it was because I kicked a stool, and that's not that impressive. Yet, I know some people get a kick out of it. And I think, I assume it. There has to be some health factors, and I would assume it's a benefit. I assume it'd be some sort of cardiovascular benefit, like eating spicy peppers. But on the other end of too little for behaviors is when you're just boring, when you're just drab. You know, I have been very depressed and low in my life, where I didn't want to give out anything and didn't want to speak. And, you know, I was just a fly on the wall and probably was not too pleasant to be around. I don't ever want to be boring. I'd rather be outrageous. I dare to be outrageous rather than be normal. We have extremes in emotions. And as I said, you cannot take on unnecessary punishment from yourself or from others for your emotions. You are always human. But it's always something to consider, the heat of our emotions, how happy or sad we are, and if our happiness is manic or if our happiness is intrinsic. At least label it. That's what I want to do. We can have extremes financially in how we decide to spend our money and how we decide to put our resources, whether our resources is conch shells or silver dollars, how we decide to spend all of our paycheck on expensive items that we do or do not need, and whether what we are buying is just cheap. And if we're buying a bunch of cheap shit and it breaks, then we're spending more money in the long run. How we decide risk. What is a necessary risk? Because that's a decision. We have to make risks all the time. But classifying it necessary, that means, oh, fuck, I really don't want to do this, but I'm going to do it. I have to do it, so I'm doing it right now. That's a decision that's made often, and we weigh it out. And that's our modern battlefield. That's where all of our stress and all of our anxiety and all the cortisol hormones comes from. We get it from establishing credit and owing debt. We get it from standing up for ourselves or standing up for your best friend or your loved one. We get it from protecting people, saying no and rejecting the pain and discord that does not need to be aimed towards you. That got a little intense. But most of what I find risk-taking worthy in my life is concerned around whether I'm fighting for something. And if I'm fighting for something, it's protecting something. And if I'm protecting something, it's rarely not me, because I haven't done a good job of taking care of myself in the past, to be honest. But I'm trying to do better, and I hope that you take excellent care of yourself. And if you haven't been, I hope that you at least consider that you're worth it, and that you're an amazing person, and that you're worth the time and energy it takes to take care of yourself. Trust me. In the big macro scale in policy making, there's extremes in policy making. And I'm not going down that rabbit hole again, because I already got way too political for one episode, and I hate politics. It makes me nauseous. I'm going to run away to the mountains, and I'm going to build a treehouse one day just so I don't have to deal with representatives, because I only want to represent myself. That doesn't mean I'm an anarchist. That means that I'm a selfist. I don't align myself with any ideology. But I think we all can think of extremes that have happened in policy making, and the extremes can be reckless and the extremes can be too little and not helping people in one's country if we are part of it. And I'm part of a country right now, and I would be willing to spend more money for people to get more assistance and more help. You know, I would always be willing for higher taxes for everybody to have free healthcare in my country. I think that's a silly argument, and I think it's incredibly low, the amount that I already pay so people can have healthcare like I get healthcare. I get social healthcare through my state. It's called Medicaid, and I love it. I wish social medicine was easier and more viable for physicians to be able to support themselves so they didn't get stiffed from the government for it. And I'd be willing to pay for it, you know? We saw a lot of free money go out last year, and I'm not sure how good of an idea that was, honestly, not to throw my political bend. But at least people thought about helping people during the middle of a crisis, and I thought that was a good sign. But over the past couple decades, even before I was born, there has been serious negligence on the state and the national level when it comes to the policymakers in my country. And I would hazard to say throughout most of the Western world, if not the Central, the Eastern, the Southern, and the Northern, all people who are making policy on the global scale right now, I think our globe is really sick, personally. All right, there's my political agenda for the day. But
within all these things, behaviors, within emotions, within financial purchase, within how we verify risk, and within policy making, within our leaders. Imagine the middle path and central way, just as a playful exercise, as a mind game. Just imagine that middleness and what that would look like. And I realize that what I'm speaking about is completely fictitious, and it might be a pipe dream. But what I've found is that when I want to create a piece of art, I have to visualize it first. So why not visualize what you want to see? And if life itself is a creative process, imagine if our politicians started acting more like artists and less like politicians. What is the benefit of the middle path if I was trying to sell it? Here's my pros and cons. I feel one benefit is that we are thinking much more clearly when we are following the middle and not intoxicated by the abundance or the mediocrity of Aristotle's vice. I feel that it's better for society and our decisions are more appreciated. I feel less guilt and less shame. I think the outcomes are generally better, especially when it comes to macro policy making. And I also think that macro policy making imitates micro policy making. So the way that leadership happens in the family is a good, it's relative. What is the con? I think it makes the them class, them being the ones that you want to fight. Especially when we have large societies where the them are underprivileged and lack opportunity and are stepped upon by the overprivileged. I feel that the extremes create larger egos within the spiritual context. And I think it makes policy more desire driven, where desire right now implies financial and economic health over humanitarian life. And I think that it can lead to more aggression and less compassion. Let's even consider this aggression and this compassion bend again this week, because I know I speak about it quite often. I think it comes from this idea of preference. What is preference? Preference being what I would like to do. I am currently aiming to do all the things that I would not like to do, because I feel that that would make me a stronger person. And I'm very grateful to the world right now for all the difficulties that I'm having to work through, especially at my work. Most of Most of my coworkers are out sick right now because, you know, everybody's sick right now. Dun, dun, dun. But it's me and my boss pretty much and one other guy at work. And I think I have a dishwasher tomorrow, but I've been doing dishes like all week and working next to my boss, and he's real intense. And so, you know, a lot of hurdles. And I walked in on Monday and I was like, oh shit. I felt my stomach and I felt kind of scared, and I felt the bend of fear, because fear is born from the preference of what I would like to do, and what I would like to do is not have to do that. And so my fear bubble has busted through my stomach wall and has started to creep up my esophagus. And, you know, my Jiminy Cricket, my lovely conscience, my octopus, whatever that piece of me that has been growing over the past couple of years that has been so supportive just went and was like, you know, just go, just be genuine, be great, be you. And I went in and I was positive and I did my job very well. And, you know, he got real mad at me and I was like, you know, I'm doing the best I can, you know, and I just kept working my ass off. And I think it's showing, and I at least feel very good about what I have put out into the world because I have been completely genuine and only showed compassion and stayed true to what I knew, what I needed to do, where I needed to be, what I needed to say. You know, you have a piece of you as well, a conscience, a Jiminy Cricket, or whatever you want to call it. You know, you just got to figure out the best way that you want to be you. I think that's one of the crucial tenets of what I want to speak about until I die. You can be the best you that you can be, and I'm not saying that cheesily. I swear. I want to help you do that. And I think that helping you is the best way that I can help me. And hopefully you can get a knack for that too and go help somebody else. That's our job. I read that somewhere. I think it was in Seneca. Where he's like, philosophy's job is for you to get up and go help people. That's what philosophy's for. Philosophy is the nurturer to lick your wounds when life's suffering has kicked you to the curb. Philosophy, and I'm paraphrasing here, roughly. Philosophy being love of thinking about why. What is life? What is this? What am I thinking? Love of thinking. Love of the W questions in the house. It's been so lovely having you here tonight with me. Thank you for listening. I can't tell you how much it means to me to have this time to be able to speak with you. Hopefully you'll take me up on my offer and find that email address. Before we get to my son, I want to read one little excerpt from Seneca because he's my current, isn't that a little orange? He's my current favorite. This is letter LX3. I don't know what L means. I think it's 50, so this might be 63, letter 63. Maybe. LX3. I'm very sorry to hear of your friend Flaccus's death. Still, I would not have you grieve unduly over it. I can scarcely venture to demand that you should not grieve at all, and yet I am convinced that it is better that way. But who will ever be granted that strength of character unless he be a man already lifted far out of fortune's reach? Even he will feel a twinge of pain when a thing like this happens, but only a twinge. As for us, we can be pardoned for having given way to tears, so long as you have not run down in excessive quantities and we have checked them for ourselves. When one has lost a friend, one's eyes should be neither dry nor streaming. Tears, yes, there should be, but not lamentation. Can you find the rule I am laying down a harsh one when the greatest of Greek poets has restricted to a single day no more a person's right to cry? In the passage where he tells us that even Niobe remembered to eat, would you like to know what lies behind extravagant weeping and wailing? In our tears, we are trying to find means of proving that we feel the loss. We are not being governed by our grief, but parading it. No one ever goes into mourning for the benefit merely of himself. Oh, the miserable folly of it all. That there should be an element of ostentation in grief. Come now, you will be asking. Are you saying that I should forget a person who has been a friend? Well, You are not proposing to keep him very long in your memory if his memory is to last just as long as your grief. At any moment, something or other will happen that will turn that long face of yours into a smiling one. I do not see very much time going by before the sense of loss is mitigated and even the keenest sorrowing settle down. Your face will cease to be its present picture of sadness as soon as you take your eyes off yourself. At the moment, you are keeping a watch on your grief, but even as you do it, it is fading away, and the keener it is and the quicker it is in stopping. Let us see to it that the recollection of those who have lost become a pleasure to us. Nobody really cares to cast his mind back to something which he is never going to think of without pain. Inevitable as it is that the names of persons who were dear to us and are now lost should cause us a gnawing sort of pain when we think of them, that the pain is not without a pleasure of its own. As my teacher Attalus used to say, in the pleasure we find the memory of a departed friend, there is a resemblance to the way in which certain bitter fruits are agreeable to the very acidity of an exceedingly old wine and its attraction. But after a certain interval, all that is pained us is obliterated, and the enjoyment comes to us unalloyed, if we are to believe him. Thinking of friends who are alive and well is like feasting on cakes and honey. Recalling those who are gone is pleasant, but not without a touch of sourness. Who would deny, though, that even an acid thing like this, with a harshness in their taste, do stimulate the palate? Personally, I do not agree with him there. Thinking of a departed friend, to me, something sweet and mellow. For when I had them with me, it was the feeling that I was going to lose them. And now that I have lost them, I keep the feeling that I have them with me still. So, my dear Lucilius, behave in keeping with your usual fair-mindedness, and stop misrepresenting the kindness of your fortune. She has given as well as taken away. Let us therefore go out into all and make the most of friends, since no one can tell how long we shall have the opportunity. Let us just think how often we leave them behind when we are setting out on some long journey or the other, or how often we fail to see them when we are staying in the same area. And we shall realize that we have lost all too much time while they are still alive. Can you stand people who treat their friends with complete neglect and then mourn them to distraction, never caring about anyone unless they have lost him? And the reason that they lament them so extravagantly then is that they are afraid people may wonder whether they did care, and they are looking for belated means of demonstrating their devotion. If we have other friends, we hardly are kind or appreciative of them if they count for them so little when it comes to consoling us for the ones we have buried. So he's talking about, his friend has sent him a letter before he has given his reply, where his friend Flaccus has died. And obviously he's grieving. And this is Seneca giving him some sort of condolence. Yeah, that's the proper word here. And he's basically telling him to feel your grief, but don't let it overtake you, and don't make it a show, because as soon as you start acting or doing it aggressively, and this form of aggression is especially Lucidius, but I was thinking about this a lot because my friends are moving and I'm going to miss them a lot. And I've had a lot of my friends die, and I think it's very common. And I want to speak about death more often on this show because I think it's important for us all to consider the importance of mortality, especially. And the reason why is exactly what Seneca ended his letter with, is that you need to go out and to love the people who are here. Yes, death is awful, loss is awful. But the best thing we can do within our grief is to expose ourselves to our loved ones and to give love unabashedly. And that's why I think about morbid things and bring darkness and things that make people uncomfortable up, and why I consider it is because I think it's healthy and I think it makes me love more. And I think it makes me more compassionate and makes me more grateful. I'm especially grateful for you as I know I've said many times. So thank you. Thank you so much for being here. Now I'm going to pass it off to my favorite little man, Ask O.
Daddy, I have to talk first.
It is time to talk. Say hi.
Hi, people.
This is Odin, and I have a sleepy boy today.
Yeah.
So all right, you go first. What's up, buddy?
I'm really sleepy today.
Are you really sleepy?
Mm-hmm.
Well, my question to you is, if you have food and it's too hot, what is it like? If food's too hot, what does it do?
Sometimes it turns soft when it's hot.
You think it turns soft?
Yeah, sometimes it turns. Too mushy? Yeah.
So you think it overcooks?
Yeah. Because I can actually feel the softness.
Really?
In my teeth.
What about if your food's too cold?
That's easy. We can cook it.
Mm-hmm. But do you like food that's too cold?
No.
So, the best kind of food is what?
A Lunchable or...
Not too hot. Not too cold. Do you remember the story of Goldilocks?
What is Goldilocks?
I've told you this story before. So Goldilocks is a little girl, and she sneaks into a bear's house. There's three bears. There's a big mama bear, a big papa bear, and a little baby bear. And he finds the porridge, and one of the porridges is way too hot. One of the porridges is way too cold. And one of the porridges is right in the middle. Which one do you think she ate?
The middle one.
Yeah. That's what I think, too.
It was too warm. It was warm.
Right. Do you want to share anything before we sign off for this week?
Yes.
Go for it.
I have a question for you guys. Are you sleepy today?
Very. All right. Have a wonderful week, guys. We'll see you next time.